Of Herbert West, who was my friend in college and in afterlife, I can speak only with extreme terror. This terror is not due altogether to the sinister manner of his recent disappearance, but was engendered by the whole nature of his life work, and first gained its acute form more than 17 years ago, when we were in the third year of our studies at the Miskatonic University in Arkham. The wonder and diabolism of his experiments fascinated me utterly, and it shames me to say that I was his closest companion. Now that he has vanished and his fiendish spell broken, my actual fear is greater. Memories and possibilities are ever more hideous than mundane and pitiful realities. The first horrible incident of our cursed acquaintance was the greatest shock I ever experienced, and it was only with reluctance that I repeat it. As I have said, it happened when we were in the medical school where West had already made himself notorious. Look, Herbert! You're called to appear before Halsey and the department heads. They cite your wild theories on the nature of death and the possibility of overcoming it artificially.
Another expulsion hearing.
It was not the first time he had come into conflict with the college authorities. His views were widely ridiculed by the faculty and his fellow students, and he was finally debarred from future experiments by no less than the dean of the medical school himself. I had always been exceptionally tolerant of West's pursuits, and we frequently discussed his theories, whose ramifications and corollaries were almost infinite. He was then a small, slender, spectacled youth with delicate features, yellow hair, pale blue eyes, and a soft voice.
Holding that all life is a chemical and physical process, and that the so-called soul is a myth, I believe that artificial reanimation of the dead depends only on the condition of the tissues. Unless actual decomposition has set in, a corpse fully equipped with organs, nay, with suitable measures, be set going again in the peculiar fashion known as life.
So you believe that the nature of life is essentially mechanistic?
Precisely! I am convinced I will discover the means for reanimating the organic machinery of mankind by calculated chemical action after the failure of natural processes.
My friend, Herbert, are you in earnest?
I have already experimented with various animating solutions, killing and treating rabbits, guinea pigs, cats, dogs, and monkeys. I actually obtained signs of life in animals supposedly dead.
In many cases, violent signs, but he neglected to tell me.
And I can already see that the perfection of this process, if indeed possible, will necessarily involve a lifetime of research.
It likewise became clear that since the same reanimating solution never worked alike on different organic species, he would require more varied animal subjects for further and more specialized progress.
I realize, of course, even a short period of death may be apt to cause impairment to psychic or intellectual life.
The slight deterioration of sensitive brain cells?
Exactly! I had hoped to find a reagent which would restore vitality before the actual advent of death, but observe! Even when this guinea pig has been freshly killed. And my solution is... just one more moment. My solution is injected into the blood immediately after the extinction of life. There, you see? No response. The natural and artificial life motions are incompatible.
It was this circumstance which made the professors so carelessly skeptical, for they felt that true death had not occurred in any case.
They did not stop to view the matter closely and reasoningly.
It was not long after that West confided to me his resolution to get fresh human bodies in some manner and continue in secret the experiments he could no longer perform openly. But where to procure the anatomical specimens?
The Potter's Field!
Why not the cemetery at Christ Church? The obvious quality of
everyone buried in Christ Church is embalmed. That would be ruinous to the research.
Oh, of course. The Potter's Field, then. I was by this time his active and enthralled assistant and helped him make all his decisions, not only concerning the source of bodies, but concerning a suitable place for our loathsome work. It was I who thought of the deserted Chapman farmhouse beyond Meadow Hill. It's far from any road and in sight of no other house. Here we are. The ground floor can be fitted as an operating room and a laboratory. And these dark curtains will conceal our light in the event someone is roaming out late.
What we can't borrow from the college, I'll purchase anonymously in Boston. We should be able to gather our equipment undetected, save to expert eyes. If we are discovered, this whole enterprise is merely a chemical laboratory. Agreed?
Agreed. Disposing of bodies is always a nuisance. Even the small guinea pig bodies from early experiments in the boarding house. At college, we used an incinerator, but the apparatus was too costly for our unauthorized laboratory. So we obtained spades and picks for the many burials we should have to make in the cellar.
A copy of the Times, please.
We followed the local death notices like ghouls, for our specimens demanded particular qualities.
What we want is a corpse interred soon after death and without artificial preservation, preferably free from malforming disease, and certainly with all organs present. Accident victim would be our best hope.
Not for many weeks did we hear of anything suitable. The college had first choice in every case on corpses for teaching purposes. In the end, though, luck favored us, for one day...
Here we are, an almost ideal case in the Potter's Field. An otherwise healthy young cleaning woman from the university drowned only yesterday in Summer's Pond and buried at the town's expense without delay or embalming.
That afternoon, we found the new grave and determined to begin work soon after midnight. It was a repulsive task that we undertook in the black small hours. Even though at that time we lacked the special horror of graveyards that later experiences brought to us.
Right here.
Ah! For God's sake!
It's all right. It's just a cat. Keep digging.
The process of unearthing was slow and sordid. It might have been gruesomely poetical if we had been artists instead of scientists. At least we can be thankful there's no rain.
Ah, damn! Hold the lantern here, will you? That's it.
All right. We scrambled down and removed the lid, dragging out and propping up the contents. I reached down and hoard the corpse out of its grave. The affair made us rather nervous, especially the stiff form and the vacant face of our first trophy.
Let's get her in the canvas bag.
We then managed to remove all traces of our visit. When we had patted down the last shovelful of earth, we set out with the specimen for the old Chapman place beyond Meadow Hill. On the improvised dissecting table in the old farmhouse, by the light of a powerful acetylene lamp, she, or rather, it, was not very spectral looking. Now, with its eyes closed, the specimen looked more asleep than dead. We had at last what West had always longed for.
A real dead body, of the ideal kind, ready for my solution, prepared according to the most careful calculations and theories, especially for human use.
The tension became very great on our part. We knew that there was scarcely a chance of anything like complete success, and could not avoid hideous fears at possible grotesque results of partial reanimation. I myself still held some curious notions about the traditional soul of man, and felt an awe at the secrets that might be told by one returning from the dead.
A larger specimen will require a greater quantity of fluid. Move the light so I can see the vein in its arm. Here we go. Now, bind the incision. Hurry, securely. Good. Now we must be patient.
The waiting was gruesome. Every now and then, West applied his stethoscope to the specimen and bore the negative results philosophically. After about 3/4 of an hour...
Well, shh! Just a moment. No. Nothing. The solution is obviously inadequate. We'll have to make the adjustments to the formula immediately if we want to make another attempt tonight.
Understood. I've got the lamp. We had that afternoon dug a grave in the cellar, which would be filled by dawn, for the body would not even be approximately fresh the next night. So we left our silent guest on the slab in the dark and bent every energy to the mixing of a new solution in the adjacent laboratory, supervised by West with an almost fanatical care. The awful event was sudden and wholly unexpected. I was pouring something from one test tube to another, and West was busy over the alcohol lamp, when from the pitch-black room we had left, there burst the most appalling and demonic series of cries that either of us had ever heard. Not more unutterable could have been the chaos of hellish sound if the pit itself had opened to release the agony of the damned, for in one inconceivable cacophony was centered all the supernal terror and unnatural despair of animate nature. We leapt to the nearest window like stricken animals overturning the burning lamp, vaulting madly into the starred abyss of the rural night. We stumbled frantically towards the town, though as we reached the outskirts, we put on a semblance of restraint, just enough to seem like belated revelers staggering home from a debauch. We managed to get to West's room, where we whispered with the lamp on until dawn. By then, we calmed ourselves a little with rational theories so that we could sleep. But that evening, two items in the paper, wholly unrelated, made it impossible for us to sleep. The old deserted Chapman farmhouse had inexplicably burned to an amorphous heap of ashes. That we could understand because of the upset lamp. But this, we could not understand. An attempt had been made to disturb a new grave in the potter's field, as if by futile and spadeless clawing of the earth.
The body had not been quite fresh enough. A body must be very fresh, indeed.
It would have been better if we could have known it was underground. For West would never afterward be able to shake off the maddening sensation of being hunted. And for the next 17 years, Herbert West would look frequently over his shoulder and complain of fancied footsteps behind him.
Sandbox Radio Howl was written by Scott Augustson, Elizabeth Heffron, Paul Mullen, and Wayne Raleigh, with original music composed by Jose Juicy Gonzalez. Howl was recorded by Christopher Stewart and mixed by Dave Pascal. Our sound tech was Max Langley, and our stage manager was Colleen Nielsen. Follow us on Twitter and catch up on any episodes you've missed at our website, sandboxradio.org. Sandbox Radio is made possible by the generous financial support of our audience members and listeners like you. Help us create future episodes with a tax-deductible donation at sandboxradio.org. Hope to see you at the next live show, and thanks for listening.